Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling, well, a truly singular figure, a man who literally lived out of a suitcase.
Just one suitcase, right, and traveled the globe doing math. Yeah. We're talking about Paul Arduce.
Exactly, and specifically, we're diving into Paul Hoffman's biography, The Man Who Loved Only Numbers. It's quite a title.
It is, and it gets right to the heart of it. This isn't just about a brilliant mathematician. It's about, well, genius taken to an almost unbelievable extreme, Paul Arduce.
Yeah, Arduce basically cut out everything most people consider, you know, normal life.
Home, money, relationships in the conventional sense, even basic stuff like cooking, all gone.
All sacrificed for mathematical truth. Is that fair to say?
I think so, yeah. The book really digs into that. What drives someone to live like that? And maybe more importantly for us, what does that kind of focus achieve?
It definitely challenges that image of the, you know, the lone genius locked away somewhere.
Right. This is about a different kind of genius, a collaborative one, strangely enough, despite his lifestyle. It makes you ask, how much headspace do we lose to just life admin?
Huh, yeah. Life admin. Arduce basically found the ultimate life hack, maybe. A very weird one.
A very weird but incredibly effective one for him. It was all about maximizing his mental energy for purpose.
Okay, so before we get into Arduce himself, let's talk about the author, Paul Hoffman. His background is interesting. Former editor of Discover magazine, publisher of Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right, and that's key. He's not a professional mathematician.
Which you might think is a disadvantage, but actually,
it's a huge advantage for this kind of book. It means he approached Arduce with an intelligent curiosity, but from the outside. He could translate the world of high-level math and Arduce's place in it for, you know, the rest of us.
Keeps it accessible. It's about the man, the phenomenon, not just theorems.
Exactly. And critically, Hoffman got incredible access. He didn't just research Arduce from afar.
No, he spent years actually with him, right, traveling alongside him.
Yeah, traveling with him, interviewing dozens and dozens of his collaborators. He saw the nomadic life up close. That gives the book this amazing intimacy and authenticity. You feel like you're almost there.
So that experience must have shaped the book's main idea. Mm-hmm. What's the core argument Hoffman makes?
Well, the central thesis is pretty radical. Hoffman argues Arduce's genius wasn't, despite his incredibly strange, nomadic, almost childlike way of life, it was because of it. His lifestyle wasn't a bug, it was the feature. It was the engine of his productivity.
How so? Because he outsourced everything.
Pretty much. By ditching all the usual stuff, owning things, paying bills, managing a home, even like social niceties, sometimes he freed up almost his entire cognitive load.
For math. Just math.
Just math. He became this human hub, this bee, cross-pollinating ideas between mathematicians all over the world because he was constantly moving.
Okay, so the book takes us on that journey from his childhood.
Yeah, it starts in Budapest with his very unusual upbringing, then follows him as he has to flee Europe, becoming this perpetual wanderer, and it tracks his absolutely massive output of papers and collaborations.
So it's his life story, but also a window into how mathematics actually works, the collaboration, the culture.
Exactly. It demystifies it a bit. Yeah. And it's really written for anyone curious about, like, what makes a genius tick? What does extreme dedication look like? You definitely don't need a PhD in number theory to get a lot out of it.
Right. It sounds more like, I don't know, an anthropological study almost.
In a way, yeah. Of this unique intellectual ecosystem centered on one very strange star.
Okay, let's dive into that life. His beginning sound, shaped by tragedy.
Very much so. The book highlights this early trauma. Just before Arduce was born, his two older sisters died of scarlet fever within days of each other.
Oh, wow. That's devastating.
Absolutely. And it meant his mother, who was a math teacher herself, became, understandably, intensely protective. Overprotective, really.
So she kept him close. Homeschooled him.
Yes, homeschooled him, creating this environment where, essentially, thinking was his only job. He had zero other responsibilities expected of him.
And the downside of that?
Yeah.
Or maybe the upside, depending how you look at it.
Well, the result was he became completely incapable in practical matters. Couldn't cook, couldn't drive, couldn't manage money. Hoffman recounts stories where he literally couldn't butter toast.
Seriously?
Yeah. He remained in many ways like a child needing constant care, but with this powerhouse intellect.
So when he had to leave Europe, that dependency, I guess, it became his way of life, the Arduce lifestyle.
Exactly. He became this stateless wanderer, For something like 60 years, he lived out of that one suitcase, moving constantly between universities and colleagues' homes.
Relying entirely on their hospitality.
Entirely. His arrival was famous, apparently. He'd just turn up, often unannounced, drop his bag, and say his signature line.
My brain is open.
My brain is open. And then it was straight to work. Intense collaborative sessions, sometimes for days on end, fueled by lots of coffee and, famously, amphetamines.
Right, the stimulants. We'll come back to that.
Yeah.
So he'd work intensely, solve problems, and then just move on.
Move on to the next colleague, the next roof, and the next proof, as the saying went.
Okay, but wait. If he's showing up, needing food, needing a bed, never paying, what was in it for the hosts? Why did this network support him for so long?
That's the fascinating part. It wasn't charity, not really. It was an investment. Hosting hors d'oeuvres meant you got access to one of the greatest mathematical minds alive, working directly on your problem.
Oh, okay. So he brought tremendous value with him.
Tremendous value. He brought insights, new problems he'd gathered from elsewhere, connections. He was like a walking, talking, mathematical journal and supercomputer combined. The contribution was worth way more than the cost of room and board.
And this collaborative nature, it's so central that it led to the Erdos number, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Erdos number. It's kind of legendary in math and science circles. It's a way of measuring your collaborative distance from Erdos himself.
Okay, how does it work?
Simple. Erdos is zero. If you wrote a paper directly with Erdos, your number is one.
Got it.
If you wrote a paper with someone who has an Erdos number of one, but not Erdos himself, your number is two, and so on.
So it's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but for mathematicians.
Exactly like that, yeah. It's a fun metric, but it also really highlights his incredible centrality. He wasn't a lone wolf. He was the ultimate collaborator, the hub of this vast network.
Okay, so he connected people. What kind of math was he actually doing? What were his specialties?
He worked in several areas, but he's most famous for number theory. That's the study of integers, whole numbers, prime numbers, really fundamental stuff, and combinatorics.
Combinatorics, that's about arrangements, patterns, counting things.
Basically, yes, sophisticated counting and structuring. But it's important to understand how he worked. He wasn't really a theory builder constructing grand systems. He was a master problem solver, and maybe even more, a master problem poser.
Asking the right question.
Asking deep, difficult, beautiful questions. And this love for problems, for elegant solutions, leads us to maybe his most famous philosophical idea, the book.
Right, the book. What exactly was that?
Okay, so the book was this imaginary book held by God, though Erdos usually called God the SF for supreme fascist.
Why the SF?
Because, according to Erdos, the SF took delight in hiding the most beautiful, elegant proofs of mathematical theorems from mortals. The best proofs, the perfect ones, were written down in the book.
So the goal for a mathematician wasn't just to prove something.
No. The highest achievement was to uncover a proof from the book. A proof so elegant, so concise, so insightful, it felt like you'd glimpsed cosmic perfection.
Wow. That gives mathematics this almost sacred quality for him. It's about discovering eternal truths.
Absolutely. He deeply believed mathematical truths were objective realities out there waiting to be discovered, like constellations, not invented by humans. They exist independently.
And that belief fueled his whole life, including his famous quirks.
Definitely. His unique language reflected this focus. Kids were epsilons.
Small quantities.
Right. People who died had simply left. But the worst fate, someone who stopped doing mathematics, they had died.
Oof. Harsh. But it shows his priorities.
Utterly. Which brings us to the amphetamine story. The famous bet with his friend and collaborator, Ronald Graham.
Yes. Graham bet him. What is it, $500?
$500 that he couldn't stop taking amphetamines for 1 month. Erdos had been using them for years to maintain his incredible working hours.
Oh.
Erdos took the bet. And he won. He stopped for 30 days. Cold turkey.
Wow. So he could function without them.
He could, but apparently he hated it. And the moment the month was up, he went right back to taking them. And his famous line to Graham was,
"You've set mathematics back a month."
Exactly. For Erdos, the drugs weren't recreational. They were tools. The cost of not using them was, in his mind, a loss for mathematics itself. His productivity dipped that month, and that was unacceptable.
It perfectly sums up his radical optimization, I guess.
It really does. And he continued working right until the very end. He left, as he would say, in 1997, while attending a math conference in Warsaw, doing what he loved.
Died with his boots on, mathematically speaking.
Pretty much the definition of it.
Okay, Thinking about that whole life,
yeah,
what are the big themes or messages that Hoffman pulls out? The first one seems clear. The link between his genius and his, well, strangeness.
Absolutely. That's maybe theme number one. Genius and eccentricity aren't just correlated here. They seem intertwined. His outsourcing of normal life wasn't a flaw. It was the necessary condition for his intense focus. It was radical, maybe even pathological, optimization.
Right. Which leads to the second theme, redefining success. He had none of the conventional markers, wealth, home, status, in a traditional sense.
Yet, by all accounts, including his own, he felt his life was incredibly rich and fulfilling. His success was measured purely by his contribution to knowledge and the joy of discovery. It really makes you question our own metrics, doesn't it?
It does. Are we chasing things that don't actually deliver that deep fulfillment? His life is a stark counterexample.
Mm-hmm. Then the third theme comes back to the book. It's about the nature of truth, specifically mathematical truth.
This idea that it's objective, eternal, waiting to be discovered,
yeah.
Universal.
Exactly. He had this deep, almost religious faith, not in God necessarily, but in the reality and beauty of these abstract truths that transcend culture, time, everything.
And finally, maybe the value he placed on pure mathematics. Stuff that doesn't seem immediately useful.
Right. He wasn't particularly interested in applications. For Erdős, the pursuit of mathematical beauty and truth was its own reward. The inherent value was in the understanding, the elegance, the glimpse of the book. Any later applications were just, you know, a bonus.
It's a powerful argument for knowledge for its own sake.
Definitely.
He also had such a unique way of speaking. The book must be full of memorable lines.
Oh, absolutely. His vocabulary was its own little world. We already mentioned a few, but there are some classics.
Like the coffee one.
Yes. A mathematician is a machine for turning coffee into theorems. It's so blunt, so utilitarian about his own existence.
Just input caffeine, output proofs. Amazing.
Then there's a standard greeting, which we talked about. My brain is open.
So simple, but it says everything. Ready to connect, ready to think. No barriers. Forget how are you. Let's do math.
Exactly. And related to the book, that great line, you don't have to believe in God, but you should believe in the book.
Which neatly separates religious faith from his faith in mathematical reality. The elegance is undeniable, whether you think a supreme fascist wrote it or not.
Right. It's about the objective beauty of the truths themselves.
One more. Maybe about his approach to problems.
Okay, how about this one? There are two kinds of mathematicians. Those who work on important problems that may not be solvable, and those who work on solvable problems that may not be important.
And you can guess which kind he preferred.
Absolutely. He was all about tackling the big, important questions, even if they seemed impossible. Go for the book proofs, even if they're hard to find.
Okay, so moving beyond Erdős himself, Hoffman's book gives us these models. How can we, you know, normal people, apply some of these extreme lessons?
Well, take the collaboration model. Professionally, Erdős teaches us something powerful about influence.
Which isn't about hoarding information.
Quite the opposite. It's about being a generous hub. Share insights, connect people, mentor the junior talent, the epsilons. Real influence comes from facilitating collective progress, not just individual wins.
That feels very relevant today, with networks being so important.
Totally. Then there's the personal takeaway from his singular focus. Now, obviously, we're not going to live out of a suitcase.
Probably not, no.
But it's a powerful prompt. What can we eliminate? What distractions, what non-essential tasks are draining our mental energy?
It forces you to identify your core passion, your math, whatever that is for you, and be ruthless about protecting time for it. Maybe it's not outsourcing cooking, but outsourcing social media scrolling.
Exactly. What's the modern equivalent of Erdős's radical simplification? What mundane stuff is clogging your cognitive pipeline? It's a great question to ask yourself.
And a third application.
The problem-finding approach. Erdős wasn't just great at solving problems. He was brilliant at finding and posing them.
So the skill isn't just answering the test questions.
It's writing the test. It's cultivating the ability to ask simple, deep questions, to frame challenges in new ways. That's often more valuable than just executing solutions someone else defined. How can you get better at identifying the real problems?
Those are really practical takeaways from such an unconventional life.
Mm.
Okay, wrapping up, what was the most surprising thing for you reading about Erdős through Hoffman's lens?
For me, it was really internalizing that his eccentricities weren't just quirks alongside his genius. They were fundamental to it. His entire life is engineered, maybe subconsciously at first, but definitely consciously later, to enable his work. It's a whole operating system.
Yeah, the idea that the flaws were actually features, it really challenges our ideas about conformity and what's necessary for huge achievement. You don't have to fit the mold.
Not at all. In fact, maybe you can't fit the mold to do something truly revolutionary.
And the final message that stays with you?
I think it's simply the profound beauty of a life dedicated entirely to the love of ideas. It sounds austere, maybe even lonely from the outside, but Hoffman portrays it as incredibly rich, connected, and meaningful in its own way.
A celebration of the intellectual passion.
Yes. And it leaves you with that challenging thought. If you could strip away everything non-essential, what deep, driving passion would you devote your life to? What's your book?
A powerful question to ponder. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.